November 20th, 2005, interview with Deepa Iyer.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, Robin.
How are we doing?
I think we're ready to go.
I wanted to ask you quickly, are you American-born, Deepa?
No.
So you immigrated to the U.S.?
Right, when I was 12.
Speakerphone?
You're on speaker, yeah.
Okay, and we're ready to go?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the important things is that most likely my questions aren't going to be included in the tape, so if you could just kind of try to include my question into your answer, that would be very helpful for me.
Okay.
Okay, so can you start by introducing yourself with your name, your title, and when you came to the United States?
My name is Deepa Iyer. I'm the Executive Director of South Asian American Leaders for Tomorrow, or SALT, and I came to the U.S. when I was 12 years old from India.
And really quickly, can you tell me what SALT has done, particularly within the context of the aftermath of 9/11?
SALT is a national nonprofit organization, and our mission is to ensure that South Asians in the U.S. are fully and equally engaged in American civic and political life. A lot of our work dates back to pre-9/11, but much of it has been focused in the post-9/11 environment in which our community has lived. And that has included community education in terms of hate crimes and bias that has occurred since 9/11 towards the South Asian community. We have published a report on the backlash against South Asians and have produced a half-hour documentary that has been seen around the country in various contexts. We've also advocated against the policies that have come out against, that have had an impact on the South Asian community since 9/11, such as special registration and arbitrary detentions. So those are some of the ways in which we've been trying to increase public awareness and do advocacy since 9/11.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back in time, and can you just tell me where you were when you found out about the attack on the World Trade Center?
On September 11th, I was actually an employee of the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division, and I was in my office in Washington, D.C. when we were given an order to evacuate the building immediately.
And what were your first, like, what were you told, what did you know was going on, and what were your first reactions?
When we were given the order to evacuate our federal building on 9/11, I really didn't know what was going on at the time. I understood that there had been some sort of incident in New York City, but wasn't clear about what it was. And I also began to understand that there was, or either had been or was going to be, some sort of incident in the D.C. area, which is where I was living and working. So a lot of confusion going on at that moment.
And then as the day unfolded and you found out what was going on in New York and, you know, you understood that it was a terrorist attack, what did you begin thinking about or worrying about?
I think that during the first 6 to 8 hours after the attacks occurred in New York and D.C., my main concern was obviously for friends and family members in those two areas, and a flurry of phone calls to check in to make sure that the people that I knew were okay. And as the day wore on towards the evening, and I would say the next day, is when it started to slowly dawn on a number of individuals, including myself, that there may be a backlash against individuals who perhaps resembled the people or communities who were alleged to have committed the attacks. And so there became a growing awareness of trepidation and fear for safety, for personal safety and community safety.
And you might have known about the history of the Japanese Americans and what happened after Pearl Harbor, so were you starting to make those connections at all?
I have to say that it was only after the first individual was murdered in Mesa, Arizona, that we began to, many of us in the community began to make some of the connections to what had happened after the Japanese American internment. We heard about the murder of a man named Balbir Singh Sodhi, who was a 49-year-old father in Mesa, Arizona, a Sikh man who actually owned a convenience store, and heard about his murder a few days after 9/11, I believe it was September 14th. And at that point, it really kind of hit home to many of us that individuals in our community were definitely vulnerable and that there needed to be advocacy and public awareness to make sure that the mistakes that had happened after the Japanese American or during the Japanese American internment were not going to be repeated. And so there began to be a number of different initiatives in D.C., New York, around the country to get the word out to the general public that in America we shouldn't tolerate backlash or violence against individuals in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the themes of, that I'm going to try to hit on this segment is the theme of de-Americanization and how immigrants of color are not perceived as true Americans. And like you said, pretty much immediately after the attacks, there were attacks on individuals and businesses and mosques. So can you give me an overview of the range of these kinds of hate crimes that happened immediately?
Immediately after 9/11, we began to see an epidemic of hate violence and discrimination in a lot of different contexts. The most tangible types of this hate violence were, of course, hate crimes. And at least five people that we know of were killed. Many of those were South Asian, several of those were Arab American. And that is one really horrendous aspect of what happened after 9/11. We also saw other types of crimes and discrimination occur, from harassment, using epithets such as "you terrorist," "you Muslim," "you don't belong here," to employment discrimination, to discrimination in public accommodations. For example, Sikhs who wear turbans not being allowed to come into a particular restaurant and being told that they needed to remove their turban, but that same restriction not being applied to others who might, for example, be wearing baseball hats. We saw it in terms of transportation discrimination, where people were basically asked to leave an airplane because other passengers felt uncomfortable and felt threatened, to Sikhs and Muslims specifically going through additional extra scrutiny as they were walking through security in an airport. So that is the range of discrimination that we began to see in the community and in the Arab American community after 9/11. And in the first week, just in the first week after September 11th, SALT did a report to look at the number of reported bias incidents that were coming from the South Asian Arab American community. And we recorded 645 incidents of bias in just the first week after 9/11. And again, these ranged from incidents occurring on college campuses to when people were driving down a highway to when people were at their workplace.
And can you please, kind of break it down a little bit for me? Because it's some of this was, especially with the Sikhs, you were saying that it was based on the turbans that they were wearing. And so it's it didn't matter if they were American-born, if they had been here, for two or three or four generations. Can you just kind of talk about that, how that played out in terms of, it was just kind of,
I think I understand where you're going with that. With hate crimes and bias and discrimination, when it's centered on a group of people, we found that it really makes no difference to a perpetrator or even to the general public about the individual characteristics of that person that they might be targeting. So, for example, regardless of whether you've been born in the country, you don't speak with an accent, you feel as American as anyone else around you, the perpetrator or the person who is harassing you, who's assaulting you, does not see you for your individual characteristics. Instead, they see you as belonging to a larger group of people against whom they have some sort of hate for, or whom they don't feel belong in the country. And so it really becomes, these sorts of acts, we say, are not acts as an individual. They're not directed just at an individual. They're directed against an entire community of people. And characteristics such as how long you've been in the country really don't matter at that point.
And so can you humanize it? Can you tell me like a specific story of discrimination or hate crime that kind of illuminates what you just talked about? Like someone who, you know, has been in the country for a long time, or someone where the perpetrator was clearly, like, seeing someone as a foreigner.
Ooh, you kind of put me on the spot there. Let's see. I guess I'm not sure that I can give you a specific story of someone who's been in the country. There have been so many stories. I don't really have anything that's kind of sticking out in on the top of my head. About someone who's been here a really long time and feeling...
Well, maybe can you talk some more about the bar of Sing Sovi? Because, like, you know, they weren't even, you know, they weren't even on the list, the government list of, like, countries to round up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, sure.
Well, I can do that, or I can tell you the story of someone else in New York whom we profiled in our documentary, except he's not someone who had been in the country for a really long time either. But in our documentary on hate crimes against South Asians, we profiled the story of a man named Atra Singh Bhatia, who was an elderly Sikh gentleman living with his family in Richmond Hill in Queens, New York. And Mr. Bhatia, on the night of September 11th, went to his local Sikh temple to pray for the victims of 9/11. And as he was leaving the Gurdwara, the Sikh temple, he was basically stopped by two individuals in a car at an intersection as he was walking home. And he was beaten with baseball bats that had nails on them. And as he was being beaten by these individuals, he was being told, get out of our country, and you did this to us. And so The fact that Mr. Bhatia was a resident of Queens, was someone who participated in religious activities, had just spent the evening praying for the victims of 9/11, really didn't have anything to do with his attack. His attackers were mainly concerned with the fact that he looked to them like the individuals who had perpetrated the attacks on the World Trade Center. And so in that way, he was disloyal, he was different, he was an other, and deserved to be attacked.
So what kind of effect did this have on the community?
The community reacted to this epidemic of hate violence, which was the first, which was really the first round of what happened. There were several pieces to this post 9/11 story, and the first piece dealt with hate violence and discrimination. The community reacted in a number of different ways. One way in which the community reacted was to make sure that we came together and made statements of unity and community through unity with other communities of color, with Arab Americans, with Asian Americans, that we made those parallels to what had happened during the Japanese American internment. So much of what we did was to come together in that way. The community also reacted by, for example, becoming very, or showing signs of our belonging to America. And for many people, this included putting up flags outside one store, on your car, outside on your front lawn, to show that, you know, we too are American, and using the flag as a symbol of that Americanness, to show that we also belong. Another way that the community reacted, some members in the community reacted, were to become more isolated, because a lot of individuals who endured this epidemic of hate violence and potential discrimination were individuals who perhaps did not have legal immigration status, perhaps did not speak English well, did not know how to report incidents of bias to law enforcement, did not trust law enforcement. So it had an effect of making those individuals feel even more isolated from the society around them. So those are some of the ways in which community members reacted to the aftermath of 9/11.
So people have noted that President Bush did caution the public from retaliating against Muslim and Arabs in this country, and that it was the terrorists that are our enemy. Do you think that that was helpful? Do you think that things might have been worse if he didn't come out and make that public statement?
One of the... Let me take that back. Let's see. We've seen that statements from public officials, from trusted government officials, can go a long way in ensuring that the public does not take out this fear or distrust through vigilante enforcement in the form of hate crimes, for example. Public statements from government officials that are repeated over and over again can help quite a bit. So when high-ranking government officials made statements right after 9/11 that we should not be taking out our anger on innocent members of our own communities, that certainly helped. However, it's important to note that we needed to hear more of those statements because the hate violence didn't just completely end a few months after 9/11. It certainly did die down a bit, but we've also seen it peaking, for example, on anniversaries of 9/11. We've seen it peaking when the U.S. government makes any sort of military moves in the Middle East. And so it's really important that those sorts of statements continue throughout, had continued throughout this period. And the fact that the government at the same time was implementing immigration policies or other types of policies that had an impact on South Asians and Arab Americans seemed somewhat contradictory to many members of our community. Because on the one hand, there were statements of tolerance and unity, but on the other hand, there were government actions that actually had a harmful impact on South Asians and Arab Americans. And so it's important to see that there could have been a dual effect, or people not exactly understanding clearly what the government was trying to say after 9/11.
And I'm going to get into those government policies in just a minute.
Okay.
So there was immediate support from many different Japanese American communities, and in San Francisco there was a peace vigil in solidarity with Muslim and Arab and South Asian communities. Do you know who Yuri Tochiyama is?
I do.
Okay, so Yuri Tochiyama spoke at this event, and she, of course, made the connections back to Japanese Americans and what happened after Pearl Harbor and internment. So can you tell me who Yuri Tochiyama is and what it meant to have people like her standing in solidarity?
After September 11th, the South Asian and Arab American communities received a lot of support from other communities of color, including the Japanese American community, which had endured similar circumstances during the internment after World War II. So individuals such as Yuri Kochiyama, who was someone who went through the internment experience in terms of having her father be taken from their home and be interrogated by the authorities for weeks and months at a time. Individuals like her, who have also made connections with the broader African American movement and the struggle of communities of color in the U.S., have really played an important role in making sure that South Asians and Arab Americans do not feel alone or isolated in the post 9/11 environment. And the types of treatment that South Asian, Arab American, and Muslim communities endured after 9/11 really does recall the history of the Japanese American internment in so many ways. And it situated us squarely with other communities of color in the U.S. who have endured similar marginalization and disempowerment.
What are some examples of the similarities?
With the Japanese American internment, or
not even just with internment, but with like the immediate roundups and.
So throughout our history in the U.S., there's been a tendency to frame certain groups of people as others, people who are different in some way from what we consider our mainstream values or what we consider is the American way of life. And throughout our country's history, many groups of people, from Jews to Catholics to African Americans to Latinos, immigrants and people of color have been framed as the other. And we saw that after 9/11, Muslims, South Asians, and Arab Americans were similarly framed as the other in America, a community that is perhaps suspicious, that is perhaps disloyal, that taken all together as a group is a community that needs to be watched, that could be disloyal in some way to America. And when you add on a few other elements, such as immigration or citizenship status, national origin, and this external environment of fear and homeland insecurity, the tendency to create these categories of who is the other in our country becomes even stronger. And in the post 9/11 environment, we really saw coming to a head this tendency of creating the category of the other, which we've seen before in our history, whether it's at the turn of the century with the immigration restrictions on people coming from Asia to the U.S., whether it was the restrictions on property ownership and citizenship that were again applied towards Asian immigrants, whether it was the internment, which made no distinction between Japanese Americans and citizens and individuals of Japanese descent. All of these moments in our history really came to a head after post 9/11 because we saw the echoes of this history of our country and the way that certain groups of people are treated in the ways that the government and the public treated South Asians and Arab Americans.
Well, the government issued an apology and admitted that internment was a mistake. Do you think that the country learned from that apology at all?
After the internment, I think that our country, our government, really did recognize that many mistakes had been committed in terms of the internment. I'm not sure that the mistakes that were learned were actually recognized or applied in the post 9/11 environment to make things different. And I think that perhaps that is because of this sense of homeland insecurity, the sense of great fear for our national security. And in those times, it's very difficult to remember the principles and the lessons that we've learned from history. And it's my hope, and I think many other individuals around the country, regardless of their ethnicity or their national origin, that our country does stay true to those principles and remember the lessons that we've learned moving forward.
Well, many people in the Japanese American community have said that they spoke out or they got involved, in solidarity with South Asian Arab and Muslim communities because they didn't want it to happen again, like the mass incarceration that happened during internment. But in addition to the hate crimes committed by citizens, the government began several campaigns targeting Muslim, Arab, South Asian Americans. So can you quickly describe some of these programs, and then we'll go into more details about a couple of them afterwards?
Sure. Along with the public actions that occurred after 9/11, the U.S. government put into place a number of different policies that also had the impact of targeting individuals of Middle Eastern and South Asian descent. Some of those included the arbitrary detentions that occurred right after 9/11. A reported 1,200 people of Arab American and South Asian descent were rounded up in sweeps that occurred around the country, primarily in New York. Many were detained and were held without access to the phone, without access to legal counsel, without access to their own families, and they were investigated for potential terrorist connections. They were held in detention centers around the country. And we have learned since then, through a report by the government itself, that these detainees were treated extremely poorly in terms of being physically and verbally abused, in terms of being denied access to express their religious faiths, and denied access to legal counsel in many situations. Of the 1,200 people who were rounded up in this way, none were charged with a terrorist-related crime. And however, many were deported for what ended up becoming or being immigration violations, which in many cases were extremely minor.
And what other programs were there?
Another policy that the government implemented after September 11th was called the Absconder Apprehension Initiative. And this was an initiative to identify and deport individuals who had orders of deportation and who had ignored those orders of deportation. But interestingly, the government decided that it would begin by identifying immigrants from certain Muslim countries first, even though those immigrants comprised a small percentage of the absconders. The government decided to focus in on this particular community first. Another policy that the government put into place were what it called voluntary interviews of individuals of Arab American and South Asian descent, where individuals actually received letters and were asked to come in to speak with law enforcement in their area and be interviewed about their potential connections to terrorist activity. Finally, one of the programs that has had, I would say, the most harmful effect on our communities has been the special registration program. And the special registration program began in November of 2002 when the Attorney General at the time, John Ashcroft, announced that this program was going to be applied to men who were 16 years and older who came from 25 designated countries and who were non-immigrants in the U.S. So that essentially means that if you were a U.S. citizen or you had a green card, you did not, or you had asylum status, you did not have to go through this program. But all others who were on some sort of visa status or who were undocumented were required to register with their local immigration office. And this particular program, as I mentioned, was only applied to individuals from 25 designated countries, and these countries tended to be countries with large Muslim populations for the most part.
I want to go back to the program that you were talking about with the roundups, because I wanted to try to tie that into what happened to Yuri Kochiyama's dad. You know, her dad was picked up the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed, and then the family didn't know where he was.
Mm-hmm.
And her mom had to, like, do all this investigation to learn that he was in a federal prison being interrogated, and they found out that the government had been watching him for a number of years. Can you kind of compare that story of him being rounded up on the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed to the story of roundups right after 9/11.
You want me to retell some pieces of that story, or?
Okay. Talk about that program, but tie it into the mm-hmm. story of Yuri Kochiyama's dad.
Okay, I'll try. I don't know as much as you do about it, but I'll give the sort of the broader strokes.
Also, this thing, because I, from what I read in your report, was that mm-hmm. That a lot of these people who were picked up were just kind of disappeared, like their families didn't know where they were.
Right, right. Sure. The arbitrary roundups that occurred in the days after 9/11 and extended for several months afterwards are very similar to what happened to many Japanese Americans after World War II.
After Pearl Harbor.
Sorry. Let me backtrack and do that again. The arbitrary roundups that occurred right after September 11th and extended for a number of months afterwards can be compared to what happened to many Japanese Americans right after Pearl Harbor. A reported 1,200 people of Middle Eastern and South Asian descent were rounded up following the attacks of September 11th and were essentially taken away from their families, from their places of work, and their families and their coworkers, for the most part, didn't know what had happened to them. They had, in the words of many community members, just become the disappeared. In many instances, this is similar to what happened to Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor. And one particular story that we can compare this to is that of Yuri Kochiyama, who is a well-known activist in the Asian American community. What happened to her father, who was picked up after Pearl Harbor and taken from his family and was interrogated at a federal prison. And in many ways, this story echoes what happened to many families right after September 11th in parts of the United States, where their men, their fathers or brothers, were taken away to detention centers, were interrogated, were investigated, and were denied access to their own family members, were denied access to counsel, were part of the disappeared in America. And it has taken a long time to get information about these individuals and their fates. Many of them have essentially been deported back to their home countries for minor visa violations.
And I want to get into special registration as well. So it sounds like there was a lot of confusion and misinformation within the community about what the program was and what the, you know, what the rules were. So can you explain why there was so much confusion about what the program was and who was obligated to go?
Special registration caused a lot of confusion and trepidation in the communities of immigrants that it was applied to. And the main reason, from our perspective, is because there was very, very little community outreach that occurred from the beginning. And this was also a policy that was confusing, because it was confusing in that there was some misinformation about who it applied to. Immigrant communities didn't know who to go to get clear information. There was very little community outreach that was done to the South Asian and Arab American communities about this initiative. The outreach that was done initially was not done in language, was not communicated properly, and there were also very small windows of time during which individuals were required to register. So, for example, for the first registration period, there may have been 2 to 3 months during which time individuals from certain countries were expected to go to their local immigration authority office and sit down and speak with an immigration official about their immigration history in the United States. With the lack of community outreach that occurred, with the newness of this initiative and the small windows of time that it had accompanying it, many community members were clearly confused, were misinformed, and felt that they were again being targeted by reason of their national origin, which is one of the main concerns that many of us had in the civil rights community.
Mm-hmm. So one of the men that I interviewed, he said that the FBI went to his mosque and encouraged the imam to tell people to go, and they were told that if they went, they would gain legal status in the United States, and that was why they went.
Some of the misinformation that was spreading through various communities can be traced to information that was either coming from government officials. Actually, you know what? Can I just take that back entirely? Mm-hmm. Let me do that over. Many community members did not understand what special registration was. They didn't understand whether it was an opportunity for them to go to immigration and have the opportunity to legalize themselves. They didn't know whether they should even go or what would happen to them if they did not go. They didn't know if they should go with an attorney or if they could go on their own. There definitely was a lot of misinformation that was being spread through the community. There was, as I mentioned earlier, very little community outreach from the government in terms of what this policy was. And at the end, many community organizations, many lawyers and advocates took it upon themselves to try to inform communities around the country about what their obligations were and what their responsibilities were under the special registration program.
Yeah, and what impact did the program have on individuals in the community? Because it must have slowly been, you know, as each different group was going and people were getting detained and then deported, it must have been really scary, you know, for whoever was going to be reporting next.
Right. In the D.C. metro area where our organizational volunteers were at the time, we actually launched an outreach program where we took information about special registration and turned it into a more understandable community education materials along with information about legal referrals. And we went to mosques around the community in Northern Virginia and in parts of Maryland to educate community members about this particular initiative. I remember being asked several times by community members saying that I want to go, but I'm really afraid of what could happen to me because I've heard stories of people being detained, being deported, and I'm not sure whether I should go or whether I should just kind of stay under the radar screen. So definitely as more and more stories came out about immigrants under this program going in, being asked personal questions such as where do you pray, being asked questions that had nothing to do with their immigration history, and then being detained and being deported in some circumstances, this definitely created another chill within our communities, another wave of fear, and increased this weight of feeling that you are constantly being targeted, that you are constantly being profiled for reasons that you just can't understand. So definitely, I think that this program, probably more than any other, really had a tremendous impact on the community psyche as a whole.
And then there were a great number of, can you talk about the number of deportations that came out of this program and kind of what effect that had on, from what I heard, it's like, you know, husbands were being deported and so women were left being single parents here in the United mm-hmm. States. Or can you give me a couple of statistics about how special registration impacted like South Asian communities?
Special registration had a devastating impact on South Asian communities, some of which we still have not been able to measure. From a number standpoint, of the total of around 60 to 70,000 men who registered through special registration, about 13,000 of them were set to be deported. And 35% of those either have been or will be deported. 35% of those who have been deported or will be deported are of Pakistani descent. And so that community, the Pakistani community especially, has been hit hard by special registration. Apart from the numbers, there have obviously been many real life, human life effects of special registration. Because this program targeted men, and many of these men, as I said, have been deported and detained and deported, what has been left behind are women who were not traditionally breadwinners and their families who now are running single-parent homes or single-family homes and have had to become sort of the head of the household for the most part. It has left behind children who have lost their fathers or their brothers, and it has created a situation where the program has really engendered a lot of additional fear and distrust in our own communities against government and against law enforcement.
And, you know, it sounds like they weren't supposed to be here anyway, that they're being deported. I mean, if they weren't here legally, I mean, to me, it would sound like the reason why they're being deported is that they weren't here legally. They were here illegally. So can you kind of explain the kind of immigration violations that people who are being deported, what kind of violations they committed?
The reason that people were deported under the special registration program is that the Immigration Service found that there were irregularities in their status, that they either had been without status for a period of time when they were trying to get status. So, for example, say that your visa your visitor visa or your student visa had expired and you had sent in an application to the Immigration Service to get it extended, but because of the backlog in the Immigration Service, there was a period of time where you were without status, where you were waiting to hear back to get the extension for your visa. There are incidents like that that people have been deported for, those sorts of visa irregularities or immigration irregularities. There have been other reasons as well that people were deported. But the point that we are trying to make is that while the Immigration Service has an obligation to detain and deport individuals who are out of status, that is their obligation as they see it and their responsibility as they see it, this particular program, the special registration program, was only applied to individuals with certain national origins. It was not applied across the board to all individuals in the United States who may have been who may have committed these sorts of visa violations or immigration violations. And it is that part of this program, the fact that it is solely based on national origin, and it's solely based on national origins of those from predominantly Muslim countries, that is what to us smacks of unconstitutionality, that really does not guarantee people equal access, due process. That's what worries us more than anything about this particular program.
Well, I spoke with my conservative cousin this morning to prepare for this interview, and what he wanted me to ask is, you know, during a time, you know, after an attack on our nation like 9/11, he was saying that we all need to do whatever we can to protect our country. And he told me the story about an Afghani doctor, you know, Afghani-American doctor who the day before 9/11 was taped. I guess he had been being spied on. And he was talking to a person named Osama bin Laden. So he got, he was one of those that were detained. He was rounded up and he was handcuffed. And he was handcuffed next to someone, next to a Lowy, actually, on this plane. And my cousin said that what this Afghani doctor said was he was scared, you know, he was uncomfortable, but that, you know, he knew that he was innocent. And so he knew that he felt like this was something that he was willing to sacrifice for the good of the nation, that if they're going to be rounding up a bunch of people and they're going to be catching some bad guys, you know, to be doing this, even though he's innocent, he's willing to kind of sacrifice that. So what do you think about that? I mean, it was a major attack on our country, and yeah, it's going to call for some kind of reaction from the government.
Right. I mean, obviously what happened on September 11th warranted a response from our government, and our government did respond in a number of different ways.
Sorry, if we could just redo that. It was getting a little bit of the paper.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Obviously, what happened on September 11th was a horrendous event, and the government was warranted in responding to that event in a number of different ways, and it did respond in a number of different ways. What we are concerned about is when government policies tend to single out a group of people who are being targeted primarily because of either their skin color or their last name or their country of origin without looking into their individual culpability. And this sort of profiling, saying that, well, because this set of people are from a particular country or because they practice a particular faith or have certain last names, well, they might be disloyal and there might be some connections to terrorists, so why not round them all up and investigate them? That to us is akin to profiling. That is akin to racial and ethnic profiling and religious profiling, because again, it takes one away from the individual culpability and makes it a group culpability, that everyone in this group is somewhat perhaps disloyal. The second piece of it that's troublesome is what happens when you have this group of people rounded up. After they're rounded up, are they being given access to attorneys? Do they have due process guarantees that everyone else in the United States is expecting if they are rounded up, regardless of their legal status or their immigration status? So it's both the initial policy itself, the motive behind the policy, when it's focused on a group of people. And then secondly, it's what happens once this policy is being implemented. How are people being treated? Are they being given their due process guarantees that they should expect from our government and from our Constitution? When we look back at what has happened after 9/11, we find that in both those instances, there are tremendous deficiencies. And at the end of the day, it has had a toll on vulnerable families, on our community members, and it has really led to this feeling of general fear among our community, a general fear of distrust. There may be people, and I'm sure that there are many people, who feel that it's absolutely and perfectly okay for the government to take these steps because we are in a time of national insecurity. And there may even be people who feel that it's their obligation to sacrifice their own civil liberties in terms of being one of those who perhaps were rounded up, who perhaps were interrogated. But I think what's important is to look at the larger picture. Are we really turning our back on constitutional principles that our country has been founded on? And if we are, and I believe we are, when we round up people arbitrarily, when we don't give them access to rights and to counsel and to open hearings, when those things happen, I think that we're doing tremendous damage to the constitutional principles of our country, which I don't think should be sacrificed even in times of insecurity such as this. In fact, I think we should hold on to them even more strongly.
Well, I'd like to have you talk some more about the racial or religious profiling, because you know, the three guys that you know hijacked the planes, it's like they weren't the old lady grandma that's walking through the airport. Like, they were, you know, of a particular fanatical religious, you know, aspect. And, you know, people will say, well, you know, if you target Muslim countries or if you target, like, Muslim Americans, you're not, I mean, that's actually kind of narrowing it down. So can you kind of speak against, like, explain to me why racial profiling or why ethnic profiling doesn't make sense?
Racial profiling has been used in our country against many communities before. And what it does is it basically takes a set of behavioral and personal characteristics, which in our case could include race or ethnicity or religion or nationality, and says that the people who have those characteristics are people who are more likely to commit certain crimes in the future. And so we need to focus in on people who share those characteristics. Now, the problem with this sort of thinking, and law enforcement has come out against this in many instances, is that it's usually very ineffective. In fact, with the roundups and with special registration, which were two policies, again, that had an impact on the South Asian and Arab American communities, the government did not charge anyone with terrorist-related activities through those programs. It's just not an effective way of capturing terrorists or individuals with terrorist activities. In fact, with the special registration program, which actually required people to come in, it's really absurd to think that people with terrorist links are going to voluntarily present themselves to the immigration authorities. It's an ineffective way of conducting enforcement. And the second reason that it's not an effective way of conducting enforcement is because it ends up creating a lot of distrust. It really makes entire communities view government authorities as a threat. It makes it difficult or impossible for community members to turn to the authorities for assistance or for protection, or even to assist them by reporting threats to public safety. So instead of using community policing, where community members are seen as agents of where community members are seen as individuals who can assist law enforcement agents, they are sort of seen as targets. And so neither is racial profiling effective in terms of capturing individuals who may be committing certain crimes, and we've seen that in special registration and the detentions after 9/11, but it also has an added impact of making it more difficult for law enforcement to depend on or rely on community members to report threats to public safety.
Great. So you went over this loss of civil liberties, and I wondered if you can just talk about that again. You know, it's like we've been talking about specific losses of civil liberties affecting, like, the South Asian community, but a lot of people, particularly, like, with the Patriot Act, you know, it's affecting everybody here in the United States in the name, you know, we're compromising our civil liberties in the name of national security. Can you talk some more about that? And, like, I read in your report you were talking about how we've been losing our checks and balances. Like, there was no oversight with the special registration program by the White House or Congress or public dialogue. Can you just talk about that a little bit more?
Many of the policies that were implemented after September 11th were actually not policies that came out of particular laws. That is, the roundups that happened, the special registration policy, these were policies that were implemented by the Justice Department and by the Attorney General's office. There was no oversight in terms of congressional oversight necessarily. There have, of course, been hearings since then to determine what happened as a result of these policies, but before these policies were even implemented, there was very little oversight or a checks and balance system to ensure that civil liberties are not being undermined or that communities of immigrants are not being targeted. Now, the Patriot Act, which actually did pass through Congress very quickly in 2001, is a law that went through Congress, but it also undermines the rights of Americans more broadly, because of some of the provisions that it contains. It also reduces judicial oversight of a large number of investigative measures, including wiretaps. It expands the government's ability to track the use of library books or internet use by individuals. It gives federal officials expansive new powers. And that's one of the reasons that the Patriot Act has been so troubling to many Americans, because it goes well beyond, sort of investigating individuals for terrorist-related activities to giving sections of government vast powers without a checks and balance system. So either through the law as the Patriot Act or through administrative measures such as special registration or detentions, what we really see are vast government powers and a lack of a checks and balance system, a lack of oversight. And so it makes it all the more difficult for more vulnerable communities to be able to respond when they are the victims or the targets of these sorts of measures.
And, you know, the fact that we are allowing all of this to happen, what kind of impact do you think that's going to have on our society as a whole?
I think that I think that there are a lot of examples of very committed advocacy since September 11th to address much of what has happened. For example, there have been around the country resolutions in city councils that basically advocate against the use of the Patriot Act, where citizens are standing up and telling their city council members to send a message through these city council resolutions that their cities do not agree with the Patriot Act, do not agree with the curtailment of civil liberties and civil rights. There has also been movement within the South Asian and Arab American communities to come together, to join with other communities of color, to take a stand against the targeting and profiling, to take a stand against the hate crimes and bias that we've seen in our communities. There has definitely been a rise in activism in the South Asian and Arab American communities since 9/11. So I think that we have seen some opportunities and some positive ways in which our communities have responded since September 11th, I don't think that it has all been negative in those respects. However, I think that we still have a long way to go in order to address what has happened over the past 4 years and to make sure that these sorts of incidents don't continue to occur in the future as well.
Well, that was perfect timing because we just hit our hour.
Great.
Thank you very much, Deepa.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope that I hit some of the points you wanted me to. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah, totally. And Brian?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, and everything's cool?
Yeah, we've got good sound. I'm going to get room tone after this, and I don't think we had any problems. I didn't hear anything. No sirens, no dorm slamming, no phones.
Okay, and nothing came over on my end because, like, you know, I had cars driving.
End of interview. Hold for 30 seconds of room tone. End of room tone and recording.